The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Guy Kiyokawa. Guy is the Deputy Director for the Defense Health Agency. And today we're going to be talking about DHA, its mission, its creation, where it's headed, what are its key initiatives for the current fiscal year and beyond. Guy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Roger. Thanks for having me on board.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. And I guess we just start with the big picture question. Can you talk a little bit about what Defense Health Agency is? It's, I guess, from government perspective, a relatively new organization going back about 4 years.
Right.
So what is DHA's role, mission?
Right. So the Defense Health Agency really is an opportunity to address across the entire enterprise of the DOD. We have Army, Navy, and Air Force medical services that are important to the missions of each of the services. The medical readiness of our force and supporting our force as it goes off to war is the primacy and the main reason why we exist. However, we also have to take care of 9.4 million beneficiaries. And what's interesting is the DHA really focuses on integrating that readiness piece for the three services
sure.
in support of the care for the 9.4 million beneficiaries. Actually, in reverse, caring for those 9 million beneficiaries helps to ensure the readiness of the medical force. So we believe that that is the best way for us to go at this is through the enterprise approach, integrating readiness with the delivery of care to those beneficiaries. The other thing that was created as a Defense Health Agency is something called a Combat Support Agency. So the department has about 7 combat support agencies. I think you are probably familiar with the Defense Logistics Agency.
Yes, DLA.
DLA. Or, you know, so these are other areas. Information Agency is another one. DISA, sorry.
Yes.
And they were also created as combat support agencies. And the other value point for the DHA is each of the services can support the joint warfight from their component perspective, which is important. But what we found is that there are gaps between what the components can do to support those combatant commands out there. And so we're not trying to duplicate what the services are doing in support of the combatant commands, but identifying those gaps based on what the combatant commands say they need and then trying to fill those gaps. So I think that's the other big mission point of the DHA.
Okay, and so and you were involved in standing up DHA, if I'm correct, is that correct?
Correct. Yes. Okay. From 2011, the Secretary of Defense had directed that we take a look at how do we kind of approach healthcare from a enterprise perspective, and a task force was created. The recommendations out of the task force was to create an entity like the Defense Health Agency. The task force also identified other areas that we could look at, particularly in geographic areas where we had Army, Navy, or Air Force hospitals in the same area. How could we provide health care in a more integrated, seamless manner for our beneficiaries? So that was the other big area that the task force identified. I came on board in 2012, actually representing the Army.
Okay.
And working for General Horoho at the time, the Surgeon General, to ensure that the Army equities were well represented as we head down the path of creating a Defense Health Agency. And then I had the opportunity to work within the Defense Health Agency as it started initially as the Chief of Staff and then being hired on as the Deputy Director.
So, you know, when what you described there, I'm trying to, you know, as someone I've worked with the Department of Defense when I was in government,
right.
And there's all the different offices. You can't begin to, as a layperson outside that, right. understand how that all works. But so it sounds like is it fair to say it's like you're pulling pieces that were that were in separate organizations together to try to leverage the capability.
Right.
I mean, it's not created from scratch. You're essentially taking functions that already exist and try to better organize them. Is that a fair way to
right.
say?
Right. So I didn't complete the storyline. So in 2012, when I got involved with this, the deputy secretary directed the department to take a look at this Defense Health Agency model and create an implementation plan. And exactly to your point, one of the things he directed were essentially 10 common functions that each of the services conducted. And is there a way for us to do this more effectively and efficiently through what eventually became known as shared services? So that was one major point, as you described, of bringing together essentially what was being three different ways of doing business into a common way of doing business.
So, you know, when I think about it, I think about when you describe that, I think about like Department of Homeland Security, like bringing together all those different departments to create a new entity. Oh, this is somewhat, I mean, this is a shared services model,
sure.
and it is a support function right. for the warfighter
right.
and their dependents. So can you, what was that like, you know, working through that process to try to pull this together so everybody was, you know, the unity of effort to try right. to, you know, implement this thing? The government is, I can say this, the government's a parochial place, right?
Sure.
So how did that work?
It wasn't easy, and okay. it still isn't easy. And because while people might see us as a healthcare organization, really the difference between us and the Kaiser Permanentes of the world is that Kaiser doesn't have to provide a medically ready force.
Sure.
And it doesn't have to provide a medical force that's also prepared to go to war, right? And that's the readiness
right.
mission. So to answer your question, I think that was and continues to be the challenge on how do you balance that. And that's why the services are still very, very important. You could call it parochialism, but quite frankly, that's the reason why we exist is,
right.
is the services supporting the service mission and the balancing part is where it makes sense and where we want, when we don't want unwarranted variation, how do we come together?
Right. It strikes me it's that balance, right, between where you can leverage common, you know, requirements
right.
versus, you know, the thing I always learned in procurement when I did procurement or still so, is that the closer you are to the requirements holder, the better the service can be.
Right.
Right. So trying to balance those two things.
Right.
So, you know, how many folks work at DHS? I mean, DHS. See, I'm already getting my acronyms wrong. Sorry, guy. Defense Health Agency, DHA.
So we have about 6,000, including mm-hmm. contractors. And what I didn't mention is the Defense Health Agency also includes managing Walter Reed National Military Medical mm-hmm. Center and Fort Belvoir Community Hospital. So that's more the direct care side of it. But as we brought in and combined some of the resources from the services to provide the enterprise approach, we did get larger, but at
All
the
right.
same time, the services got a little bit smaller, and it's a work in progress.
Sure.
I would say that the information technology realm became the obvious benefit to coming up with enterprise solutions. Recognizing how different the services were, the medical services
yes,
were,
yep.
we probably underappreciated the differences. We're still in the throes of bringing the three services' IT infrastructure together
mm-hmm.
into something we're calling the Medical Community of Interest or MedCOI. But one of the huge benefits, and you know, this started back in 2013, and now, as you know, the huge emphasis on cybersecurity. And of course, when it comes to security with the Department of Defense, there is no hill that can be unclimbed
taken.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
So to speak,
we're
right?
going to take every hill and minimize every risk, and rightfully so. And along those lines, the benefit of us coming together in the IT infrastructure as it relates to cyber is that the interesting thing is that when the rest of the department looks at medical, they see us as a risk area because our whole mission is to stay interactive with our beneficiaries.
Right.
So we have patient portals that have to interact with people on outside the wire, so to speak, and that increases the vulnerability to the rest of the system. So by having a MedCoy, we're able to partition out this combined network from the rest of the Department of Defense while ensuring that we still have the necessary security in place to not affect and create more risk.
Sure. Guy, when we're up on the break already. Okay. So when we come back, I want to just pull another string and just ask you about the modernization and dealing with your information technology infrastructure and how that relates to business operations. You know, they tie together. And
absolutely.
Do you change the business processes to address the IT, or how do you do that a little bit? And then we can get more directly into exactly how you support the warfighter, what medically ready means
right.
in terms of deployment and that sort of thing. My guest today is Guy Kiyokawa. He is the Deputy Director for Defense Health Agency, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Guy Kiyokawa. He is a Deputy Director for the Defense Health Agency. And we're talking about its mission. It was set up 4 years ago, which is a relatively short period of time in government, in the government world. And Guy, when we took the break, we were talking about information technology and leveraging that in a shared services model. And I wanted to follow up on that and just ask you, because when you're trying to make, execute change and implement new systems, especially in IT, it's not just the IT system, it's your business processes. How do you
right.
marry those up
right.
so it makes sense? You can be more efficient, more effective.
Right.
Is that a big challenge that you guys are dealing with?
Oh, absolutely. Anyone,
I think I knew the answer to that question.
But. and most of your listeners probably can appreciate that. Our joke in our staff meeting is the IT guys are just the tools,
Right.
And of course, the CIO takes exception to that, but he actually acknowledges that like many other areas, logistics facilities, they're in support of the mission and the operations. And I'm assuming in the industry, it's the same thing that we tend to latch on to what we call the bright, shiny object, right? That you see at Best Buy and it promises to do all these things. So why can't we just do it? In our office space, and sometimes it ends up in your office space because they can acquire it
right.
using their government credit card. And the next thing you know, it's attached to your network. And the next thing you know, your network manager can't manage it all. Right. So I think to your point, it really goes back to figuring out what the operations are and how can IT better support that. So if I could clarify the shared services terminology, I think we used to use it because it's what we agreed to with the three services, but Admiral Bono has definitely transitioned now to calling it enterprise support activities because it's much larger and broader mm-hmm. than what we had originally agreed to. And especially in the IT space, we definitely have to go there, and we are going there.
I like that enterprise too. It to me sends a message of a common, it's an enterprise, a common endeavor to support.
Right.
Shared services is
right.
shared services.
It's
right?
what you decide to share.
Right.
And
exactly.
There's other things that you decided not to share.
So you can tell her I like that. Okay?
Yeah. So back to the IT space. At the break I mentioned our electronic health record,
mm-hmm.
MHS Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
We started what we call our IOC site, initial operating capability, up in the Pacific Northwest. We went live at 4 MTFs up in the Pacific Northwest, and like any IOC site, we hit smack dab into all the challenges and even beyond that we had expected. And many that we didn't expect. And so we're rallying around those lessons learned. But to your original point, we knew going in 2 years ago plus in talking to private sector healthcare organizations that had implemented electronic health records that the key to the implementation was going to be what they call workflows
yeah.
or your operations, right? And And the difference for us was to make a change from CHCS and ALTA, which are existing electronic records, which we modified over and over again so that it would fit the way
we tailored it. Typical government, right? Things that happen. Yeah.
Because it's easier to do that rather than changing the way you do business.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, now we made a conscious decision to go with the off-the-shelf product with Cerner. And not only is it a proven product, but really, we're looking at this more as a transformational initiative as opposed to just implementing or deploying an electronic health record. So back to what we learned from all those different private organizations that had implemented EHRs, we made a point of defining that those specific workflows that are both clinical and business, and then trying to figure out how do you implement it, given that your culture in the past, as I mentioned with CHCS and ALTA, was don't change the way you do business, change the system. And we can't. And the reason we can't is because it's an off-the-shelf record. And I think the aha moment for me was the difference between modifying the EHR versus the fundamental, I don't have the right words, but you know, sometimes when you customize it,
right.
Now you've purchased all the upgrades in the future because it's
you're tied to the product.
Correct.
All the time.
Cerner did it just for you and not for all its other customers. So
right.
You bear the cost of those upgrades in the future.
Right.
And so I think now all of a sudden we start thinking more like the private sector, where there's an expense to doing this.
Right.
And you have to balance that with the expense of changing the way you do business. And so that, I think, has been the challenge. We brought the experts together from the field to develop these work streams, but you can only imagine implementing that at a specific hospital results in people not necessarily accepting the workflow.
Right. They're used to doing things the way they've always done, right?
Right. And so there's this immediate reaction to try to change the system,
right?
Or
to accommodate the way you've always done it.
Correct.
And the thing I always used to hear is like, well, why are you doing it this way? Because we always have, right?
And in medical, you know, we get a little bit more dangerous because then and many times rightfully so, we say it's a patient safety issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and we're going to hurt someone. So and that's a real perspective, and we don't want to ignore that. But at the same time, that's the challenge. How do you balance during a deployment, changing the way you do business while ensuring you're still providing that safe and quality care?
Right.
And I think that's what we found is that's where the services are so important, because the commanders of those hospitals take command.
Yeah.
And while there's an external entity helping them to transition to a new electronic health record, at the end of the day, they're still responsible for the quality and safety in that hospital. And so we always defer to the commander to make that call, but we want to support that commander as we move forward.
Right. So, before we turn to, medically ready for deployment and how you directly support the warfighter day in and day out, I just a quick couple questions about data and the importance of data. It seems to me as you go through this, business transformation, right, creation of the new organization, and then trying to address, business processes as well, the importance of data and being able to collect that and analyze it, that could be a game changer for you. What are you guys doing in that area? Where do you see opportunities?
So if you recall before the break, I talked about the MedCoy and starts with the infrastructure,
yes.
Common infrastructure. It's not like we have enough big challenges, but the other big challenge is really rationalizing our portfolio of applications, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all those systems out there, they're hanging off the network down at the hospital level within the services. I mean, I can't even appreciate how much is out there, and those are the things that we know about.
Right.
You don't know until you bump into it. So I think to answer your question, the more we can wrap our arms around rationalizing the portfolio, the better we can start defining what those key data sources are. Don't get me wrong, we already have something called M2 that draws in a lot of this data, and we get a lot of rich analytics out of it. But narrowing that field down is going to help us focus more on what Admiral Bono likes to call, you know, making decisions based on the data. If you don't have decision making based on the data, then you tend to make decisions based on anecdotes.
Yes.
And while depending on who's portraying the anecdote might drive the decision, it doesn't matter who's portraying the data because the data speaks for itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's such a common thing when you describe rationalizing the different systems you have, programs, whatever. I hear that throughout government, just it's in a current state where there's just, they've customized things, they've created, programs or systems to address small pieces of an overall function.
Right.
And trying to pull that all together so you can make sense of it is a uniform challenge that lots of folks are having to deal with. This is fascinating stuff. My guest today is Guy Kiyokawa. He's the Deputy Director for Defense Health Agency. And when we come back, we're going to talk about medically ready for deployment and the direct support that DHA provides to the warfighter and their dependents. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Guy Kiyokawa. He is the Deputy Director for the Defense Health Agency. And Guy, I know we've been talking about lots of organizational structures, change, IT. This segment, let's talk a little bit just about, the direct support and capabilities that DHA provides to support the warfighter. And first, there's a couple terms here that we've talked about just generally off air, and that's medically ready for deployment and ready medical force.
Right.
And let's talk about, I guess, medically ready for deployment. What is that all about? And what's DHS's role? I do that all the time. DHA's role. Wow.
So maybe when your editor edits this segment.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Guy. Don't no, you're giving away secrets now, man, on the show.
No, for my part, I would say we should probably put this up front because it's actually a disservice for us to be this far in the interview and talk about how
well,
we
that's
support my, the warfare.
That's on me, Guy.
No.
I apologize.
No,
for that,
I think this is important because this is the reason why we are here.
Yep,
and we tend to absolutely forget about it because of the numbers and the dollars and the data and so on and so forth. But this is about the warfighter, and this is what separates us from other healthcare systems. So one of the things that the warfighter and people, the good thing is people don't recognize this, which means they expect it and they're confident in the fact that it's already happening. But essentially what we're saying about medically ready force is that every one of your soldiers, sailor, airmen, marine, coast guardsmen that goes off to do whatever it is they've been asked to do, that they're medically prepared to encounter whatever dangers are out there. And I'm not talking about necessarily the kinetic threats. Right. People don't realize in the history of warfare that what we used to call, what we still do call DNBI, disease and non-battle injuries, were probably the greatest threat to armies and the military in the history of warfare. And obviously, the advancements in technology have really put a dent into that. And that's because our service members are medically prepared whenever they deploy. And so this is everything from having the right vaccinations, immunizations. Also, what people can't even appreciate is how important dental is. But if anybody's had dental pain,
right, that's pretty distracting, that's, right?
that would be one of those things that would put you out of commission.
Yeah.
And now, off the comment here, but you know, somebody might say, well, just pull out the teeth and you don't have a problem, but yeah, I got it, but that's not the way we operate.
Right.
And so dental readiness is a big part of it. So there's things like that that constitute whether or not every single service member is medically prepared to go to war, so that they are not diverted from their mission because of something that could be prevented. The other part of it is once they are in a theater, and it differs between the services, and this is one of those differences I talked about.
Yeah.
You know, your soldiers or Marine put a boot on the ground somewhere. As soon as they put a boot on the ground, they're exposed to the entire environment, which may not be the same type of environment back here in the United States. So how do we keep that protective shell around them? Everything from... in the public health realm, people don't realize that one of the primary missions of veterinarians in the military is food service inspection. Because
really?
Many of your food products are locally sourced. Well, someone's got to make sure that the source is coming from an effective environment to ensure the safety of those consuming those food products. And so, you know, when you look at the veterinary schools around the country, people don't realize that, you know, caring for little animals is just probably one segment of what a veterinary student learns. And so that's really one of the primary missions. So it's all those things to protect that service member. You know, for the sailors on ships, it's the public health on a ship. But then when they dock, now they're exposed to other threats. For airmen, it's their bases, right? And
mm-hmm.
So the Air Force tends to focus public health once you get inside the wire. So it's a different focus for each of the services depending on where their serviceman puts a foot on the ground. And that's part of that extended protecting the force and making sure they're ready to deploy.
Right. And it, you know, when you described it, I just think about how, you know, because it's all about teamwork, right? I mean, everybody plays their role.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone is less than optimal due to some health concern while they're on deployment, that impacts the entire organization, right?
Right.
It's the stakes are really high.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, obviously, right?
Right.
But yeah.
Right.
So what, you know, you described all that. I think when folks are deployed, I guess there's also the ready medical force.
Correct.
That supports in the field.
So
what is that?
Right. So that's what I previously talked about was the DoD writ large. Now what I'm talking about with a ready medical force is all your medical personnel that are going to deploy, are they ready to do their mission? Right? And people just assume when you say medical force, you think of doctors.
Yes.
But really, it's not just doctors, it's nurses, it's allied health sciences, and those are just the providers, but it's our medics, it's our medical logisticians, it's our administrators, it's our IT personnel. So it extends to the whole spectrum of professional areas within the medical force. And so the question then becomes, are they prepared to deploy? And I think that's where this unique balancing act between our readiness and health delivery comes into play. And that's where the Defense Health Agency can really push that forward and support that. Because one would just assume that, well, if you're operating in a hospital, then you're ready to go to war, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, yes and no. And the last 15 years of war has shown us that while we've done a great job, we've really reduced the fatality rates on the battlefield today. The real question becomes, are we agile enough to be able to respond to the next encounter? Because it may not be the battlefield. It may be disaster response or whatever those missions are. And so what are those specific knowledge, skills, and abilities that our service medical service members need in order to be able to do those missions? And then can we shape the delivery of healthcare to support that? And so that kind of brings this really interesting dilemma that we have, which is, should we be doing all healthcare for the 9 million beneficiaries in our hospitals to ensure that is supported? Well, yeah, if that was feasible, but it's not. Then more importantly, can you define what those requirements are And then can you leverage things like the TRICARE health plan to start shaping what types of cases and what types of case mix is required in our facilities to support that readiness mission? And right now, our TRICARE health plan is more viewed as a separate health plan than the care provided within the facilities, the medical treatment facilities. And so that's another part of the DH, is to integrate between TRICARE, that purchase, what we call purchase care, with the MTS, which is the direct care. How do you integrate that so that you're most effectively supporting that ready medical force perspective that I just described to you?
Right. And you get, I mean, you, if leveraging those or how you integrate those ultimately gets back to outcomes, right? And kind of how can you leverage them to get to ensure even better outcomes for the warfighter and the dependents.
Right.
And then also it seems to me part of that would be if you're able to integrate those better, you'd also be more efficient, right?
As absolutely. In fact,
so if you get better outcomes and more efficiency.
Right. And and you know, if you really read the 41 sections in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2017, I mean, I'm no expert on NDAAs, but that one was a unique one in that it actually told a story. It walks us right down from 721, identifying your medical readiness requirements that I just described.
Yeah.
725 said, how do you measure it? Because you got to be able to measure it. And then many others on how do you leverage the private sector and the VA to ensure you have the right case mix. But really, to your point, getting to Section 703, which essentially says, you know, then right-size the capabilities and capacities of your military treatment facilities so that you can walk a dog all the way back to that readiness requirement.
Right.
And then ask yourself, is the rest of that still necessary to support readiness, or do you need more just in different areas? And that's what 703 is telling us to do. And I believe the department would like to get to that point in order to find those efficiencies, but first and foremost, make sure you're effective and it's tied
and
to
delivering the care that you
to a readiness requirement.
Right.
And so I think that's what's interesting is we've been on this road for a little over a year in responding to the NDAA 17.
And you know, that's a great place to stop and just segue for the next segment. We'll talk about that road you've been traveling with regard to last year's NDAA. My guest today is Guy Kiyokawa. He is the Deputy Director for Defense Health Agency, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Guy Kiyokawa. He is a Deputy Director for the Defense Health Agency, and we've been talking about the DHA's mission. Ah, I got it right, huh?
Hey,
didn't slip that time, right?
All right. Last segment, got it right, Robert.
Screwed that up. Yeah. like you said, as you referenced, that's why we have an editor. So,
right.
But this segment, towards the end of the segment, Guy, you had mentioned the NDAA and the road that your organization is traveling to implement, execute on the provisions of the NDAA in the healthcare area. And I just wanted to open it up and let you talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So before the break, I kind of went down the path in some of the sections that focused on the medical readiness requirements. And the reason that's important is because then the services would place where their active duty medical force would be located within the medical the military treatment facilities. And then the other parts of the NDAA really started to reform TRICARE. And Admiral Bono recognizes that the TRICARE of the past is not the TRICARE of the future. In fact, when we started talking about before the break, integrating between the what we call the direct care system or our MTFs with the purchase care, which is TRICARE, the NDAA has a section in it that essentially says that the DHA will now administer and manage all the military treatment facilities. And once again, this is not something that's easy as we started the discussion to work through, because there are a lot of important equities here that it's not just this part and parcel transfer from the Army, Navy, and Air Force to the DHA, there is this balancing act. And so how we do that, we're working through that right now, but that's one of the sections. There are other sections in the NDAA that talk about the reform of TRICARE. And what we decided to do is we had a very, very successful award of our TRICARE 2017 contracts. We went from three contracts covering the nation to two contracts. And for the first time that I can remember, we survived every GAO protest.
Big protest, okay.
COFC, which is the Court of Federal Claims. All those protests were denied, which is absolutely a testament to those who developed the requirements and ran through the whole acquisition process. And I'll give a shout out to Mr. Bill Thresher, who led the selection process, and what a great process he led. Very transparent. But anyway, we delayed the implementation of TRICARE 2017 to coincide with these changes in the NDAA. And it's all going to happen on 1 January 2018. One of the big changes that the Congress has asked us to do is to take what was known as TRICARE Extra and TRICARE Standard and turn it into something called TRICARE Select. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, believe it or not, those who were in TRICARE Standard didn't have a requirement to enroll, actually could tap into the system whenever they wanted to, in addition to whatever the health care they had, which was great from a beneficiary perspective. But in trying to manage the system, it's very hard to manage a system where you don't know what percentage of your 9 million beneficiaries are really going to start to access your system.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine. That sounds, yeah.
Yeah, so TRICARE Select requires everyone to now enroll. And in order to ease that transition, we're given a year to automatically enroll. And then we're going to move into the space like other, well, like insurance companies. And I want to point out that we are not, TRICARE is not an insurance plan. It's a benefit. And that's fundamentally different when you look at the business model behind it. But we started to recognize that running TRICARE as a benefit started to confuse not only our beneficiaries, but the providers that we're trying to get within our networks, because it looks so different. So one of the other aspects that is changing is implementing an open enrollment season, like everyone else has.
Yeah.
Except for our beneficiaries, it's like, what does that mean? And so in the first year, we're automatically enrolling everyone from Extra and Standard into Select. And then we'll have an open enrollment season, but it really won't start hitting people till the second year. And so what's going to be interesting is to see who opts out of TRICARE Select versus who remains in on an annual cycle, just like every other managed care organization does it. So we look at that as being a benefit in two ways. Number one, as I already mentioned, this should help simplify the way providers see TRICARE. But number two, it will help us to start managing our markets, because we're going to know who is actually enrolled to access our system.
Right. You have a better understanding who's using what, and
right.
And correspondingly, you know, how to deal with the providers, right?
Right.
And from a service delivery perspective, right?
So you know, between the readiness piece of the NDAA that leads us to what's in our military treatment facilities, to the reform of TRICARE, now all of a sudden, as I mentioned, the integration between readiness and health delivery, the integration between TRICARE and the direct care system, which is our MTFs, and then finally, with Section 702, as we work through this change of administering the MTFs in these what we call multi-service markets, where you have an Army, Navy, or Army, Air Force facilities.
Or perhaps all three.
Or all three operating in the same geographic area. How do we maintain that readiness? But for me as a beneficiary, how is that system integrated and seamless?
Right.
Because in the new generation, most beneficiaries just want access to good care, and they want it to be seamless and hassle-free. And so can we do that given these differences across the services? And that's where the DHA squarely fits in.
So you'd be willing to go to a Navy as an as a retired Army officer, you'd be willing to go to a Navy facility, right? As long as it's seamless and
right. Oh, yeah. I mean, just ask my wife, right? She doesn't care.
Right. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. So we got so how long is it going to take to get to where you want to get with that? I mean, it seems to me over the course of the show, you've described some huge structural management challenges, changes. What is this? Is how long does something like this really take till you start seeing, you know, the return on it?
So I think there's two answers to that question. I think the easy answer is that it never ends, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is part of kind of continuous process improvement. The neat thing is even before all this, we and the services all signed up to what's known as a high reliability organization model. Which is really initially focused on patient safety and quality, but really extends to just the a change of culture and continuous process improvement. And I think that is really, really important. And to say that you've gotten there is admission that you haven't gotten there. And so I think that's the easy part to the question. I think the harder part to the question is, you know, as you stated at the top of the show that, wow, what a challenge when the government tends to be very parochial. I think we see this as generational.
Yeah.
I think you know, what we're really good in the military is training and moving up our young leaders. And I think when leaders come through, whether it be through our graduate medical education programs or coming in as young ensigns and lieutenants and seeing a world order that I was not raised in, that it is integrated and at the same time balancing the service uniqueness, I think that's the generation that then will be prepared to address those other challenges that are going to hit us, because clearly the world's getting more complex, particularly as it relates to the role of the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
So to answer your question there, I think it's generational for the second part, and then for the first part, it's continuous.
It never ends.
It never
ends.
Yeah. Right.
That's a great way to look. I mean, that's the way you have to look at it, right? Because, you know, society changes, people's needs change.
Right.
Yeah, the world changes.
Yep.
You have to be able to evolve to meet the new needs of the warfighter. I got about a minute left, Guy, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. You played a role in, you know, standing up DHA. You've played a leading role in, you know, implementing, you know, these. And continuing to implement, as it never ends, you know, the provisions in the NDAA. You know, what, from your perspective, what are some of the keys to sort of change management? How do you get organizations and people who may have different stakeholders to move, you know, with unity of force?
Right. So, you know, you can read all the change management books and you hire all the consultants and you get all the book answers, which are great. I mean, I got to tell you, they make all the sense in the world. You know, looking at leaders, it's all about leadership buy-in, getting those who are part of the process to develop the new processes. And that's all true. But I think one thing we learned is that it rarely works out that way. And so the real question is, you know, how do you leverage the reality of personalities and start turning it into structure? Because structure over a period of time will start to minimize that wide variation of personalities, right? And
sure,
so personalized still remain important, but how can you manage that a little bit better? I think that, and we're not even there yet, but I think that tends to be one of the keys that we're encountering right now.
Mm.
Hey, Roger, I forgot.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. Yes.
So I mentioned about the reform of TRICARE, and we could spend a whole nother show talking about the TRICARE changes. But if anyone listening,
perhaps you will, Guy.
Yeah. Well, it's important because it affects so many people out there. If anyone out there would go to tricare.mil/changes, that's tricare.mil/changes. I think as a beneficiary, you'll be able to see some of the big changes that are coming up to our programs that are affecting you in many ways. Some of which might not be viewed as a positive change, but I would ask you to put a lens on it that it's not just about taking care of the beneficiaries. It's really about how do you support the warfighters. And as the secretary said, he wants to increase the lethality of the force. And quite frankly, healthcare management is one of those business functions that the deputy secretary is focused on reforming in order to help pay for some of that increased lethality of the force.
Yeah. Greater efficiencies.
Yep.
Yeah. Absolutely. I want to thank my guest today, Guy Kiyokawa. He is a deputy director for the Defense Health Agency. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.